Hello, I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This is the American Israelite program, The News of the Jews. We're going to start off with a program at the Jacob Rader Marcus Center of the American Jewish Archives, along with the Leo Beck Institute. We'll present a conversation with Rabbi Sally J. Priceand and Sonia K. Pills on Women in the Rabbinate, Then and Now. This is a program for Tuesday, September 17th, beginning at 4:30 p.m. with a reception, followed by a program at 5:30 at the Jewish Foundation of Cincinnati International Learning Center at the Marcus Center on the Cincinnati campus of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. The event is free and open to the public. Dr. Gary P. Zola, Executive Director of the Jacob Rader Marcus Center of the American Jewish Archives, and the Edward M. Ackerman Family Distinguished Professor of the American Jewish Experience in Reform Jewish History, and William Weitzer, Executive Director of the Leo Beck Institute, will moderate and participate in the evening's conversation. LBI, the Leo Beck Institute, is a research library and archive in New York and Berlin focused on the history of German-speaking Jews. The evening's program will begin with a special presentation of the Jacob Rader Marcus Award to Jay and Shira Ruderman in recognition of their contributions to the study of the American Jewish experience. Recently, the Ruderman Family Foundation funded the establishment of an MA program on the American Jewish experience at Haifa University. The academic program is unique in Israel. Master of Arts students, MAs, study a range of issues pertaining to American Jewish history, contemporary American society, and the long-lasting and important bonds that links the Jews of America, the State of Israel, and Israeli society. Many of the Ruderman MA students have come to Cincinnati to study at the American Jewish Archives. Rabbi Zola said, "It is most fitting that we will hear firsthand about the barriers two pioneering women rabbis had to surmount on their journeys to ascend to the rabbinate, while honoring two outstanding philanthropists whose noble work has focused on inspiring Israelis to enter the study of Jewish life in America. The Ruderman Foundation's efforts to help Israelis better understand American Jewry eases the burden some aspiring women rabbis may feel when wondering if or how their rabbinic careers will be affected by their gender. The fascinating story attendees will hear from the pioneering women rabbis on the panel will powerfully illustrate how much they have impacted the then and now for future women rabbis, and what more must be done to achieve full gender parity on the pulpit. The story of women in the rabbinate illuminates the connections between German and American Jewish history. When Sally J. Priceand was ordained by Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in Cincinnati in 1972, she became the first woman rabbi in North America. Yet, the first woman rabbi in Jewish history was actually a Jewish woman, a German woman, Regina Jonas, who lived from 1902 to 1944 and was murdered at Auschwitz. In 1999, the Abraham Geiger College at the University of Potsdam in Germany was founded and became the first liberal rabbinic seminary in continental Europe since the Holocaust. Rabbi Sonia Pills was ordained there in 2015, only 5 years after the college ordained its first female rabbi, Alina Trieger. Temple Sholom is going to be among the participants in Sabbath service addressing gun violence and white supremacy. Faith in Action's Live Free campaign hosted Peacemaker Sabbaths at houses of worship across the country. Temple Sholom participated this past Sabbath. Live Free encouraged clergy and lay leaders to consider their roles as peacemakers in a violent world and to host at least one Sabbath during the month of August to bring attention and answers to the gun violence epidemic and how communities can tackle white supremacy. The Sabbath events come after a string of three tragic massacres in less than a week, all involving gun violence to carry out a mass killing, with several rooted in white supremacist hatred. Live Free wanted those affected by both urban gun violence and these acts of terrorism know that there are proven strategies to significantly reduce gun violence in some of the most dangerous neighborhoods. At each Peacemaker Sabbath, the hosts preached, prayed, and acted with and for those affected by gun violence, using their pulpit to move their congregations to take action by calling on members of Congress to pass House Resolution 8, a comprehensive backgrounds checks bill, and take time to learn more about the root causes of gun violence. Let's talk about Mr. Trump's recent comments about Jews. If you're a Jewish Democrat, I think President Trump just called you a bad Jew. This from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. And it is written by Andrew Cello Carroll. He's the JTA's editor-in-chief. If you're a Jewish Democrat, I think President Trump just called you a bad Jew. That's not the prevailing interpretation of remarks made by the president on Tuesday when he told reporters, "I think any Jewish people that vote for a Democrat, it shows either a lack of knowledge or great disloyalty." A lot of Jewish leaders who exploded over the comment felt the president was touching on that classic anti-Semitic canard that Jews aren't sufficiently loyal to the countries in which they reside. Anti-Defamation League CEO Jonathan Greenblatt tweeted, "It's unclear who POTUS, President of the United States, is claiming Jews would be disloyal to, but charges of disloyalty have long been used to attack Jews. If this is about Israel, then Trump is repeating a dual loyalty claim, which is a form of anti-Semitism," said Haley Soifer, executive director of the Jewish Democratic Council of America. Trump's lack of clarity certainly makes it possible that he was conjuring up dual loyalty. But here's the thing with Trump. He doesn't think dual loyalty is necessarily a bad thing. Back in April, he referred to Israel's leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, as "your prime minister" in an address to a group of Jewish Republicans. Critics heard the dual loyalty charge, but it is clear in context that he thought it perfectly natural that a group of hawkish Jewish Americans would regard Israel's prime minister as theirs. If anyone in the room objected, there's no record of it. So if not dual loyalty, what else was Trump thinking? Is it possible Trump considers Jewish Democrats as disloyal to him? Disloyal is a curse in Trump's famously limited rhetorical vocabulary. He's deployed it against fellow Republicans who don't show him sufficient fealty, against corporations that oppose his policy, and, this is key, against opponents who appear disloyal to each other. He once disparaged Hillary Clinton as disloyal because she undercut Bernie Sanders. He regards disloyalty as a character flaw. Trump watchers, like Washington Post Mark Fisher, suggests that Trump takes his cue from real life and movie mobsters, learning that the way to insulate himself from the betrayals and backstabbing of the business world was to place a premium on loyalty. Andrew McCabe, who briefly replaced James Comey as FBI director, once referred to Trump's kind of overwhelming and overriding focus on loyalty and sorting everybody out immediately, like, you're either with us or against us. Trump has famously complained that evangelical Christians have shown him more gratitude than American Jews for moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv. I'll tell you what the president told Mike Huckabee last year. I get more calls of thank you from evangelicals, and I see it in audiences and everywhere else, than I do from Jewish people. And the Jewish people appreciate it, but the evangelicals appreciate it more than the Jews, which is incredible. Trump gave credence to this interpretation of his remarks in a tweet storm Wednesday morning. He quoted at length the conservative talk show host, conspiracy theorist, and self-described Jew-turned-evangelical Christian Wayne Allen Root, who wondered why American Jews don't show the president more respect. Trump tweeted, thank you to Wayne Allen Root for the very nice words. Then he quoted Root as saying, President Trump is the greatest president for Jews and for Israel in the history of the world, not just America. They'd love him like he is a second coming of God. But American Jews don't know him or like him. They don't even know what they're doing or saying anymore. It makes no sense. He is the king of Israel. Later Wednesday morning, however, Trump appeared to change course in attempting to clarify what he meant. If you vote for a Democrat, he told reporters, you're being disloyal to Jewish people and you're being very disloyal to Israel. First, the Israel thing. In context, it does make more sense if Trump were saying Tuesday that Democratic Jews were being disloyal not to America, but to Israel. Again, consider the context. Trump had been attacking Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, two Democrats who have been harshly critical of the Israeli government and who support the Boycott Israel movement. Omar had talked the day before about cutting off aid to Israel for its treatment of the Palestinians. Trump fumed, I can't even believe we're having this conversation. 5 years ago, the concept of even talking about this, even 3 years ago, of cutting off aid to Israel because of two people that hate Israel and hate Jewish people. I can't believe we're even having this conversation. Where has the Democratic Party gone? Where have they gone where they're defending these two people over the state of Israel? And I think any Jewish people that vote for a Democrat, I think it shows either a total lack of knowledge or great disloyalty. All right? So that's three possibilities as to what Trump meant by great disloyalty. Disloyal as Americans, disloyal to Israel, or disloyal to Trump. And maybe four, if you add the possibility that Trump wasn't even sure what he meant. But Trump adds a fifth interpretation, which may be the most convincing. Jews are being disloyal to Jewish people. That's what the Republican Jewish Coalition insisted in a tweet Tuesday. The RJC wrote, President Trump is right. It shows a great deal of disloyalty to oneself to defend a party that protects and emboldens people that hate you for your religion. Disloyalty to oneself. The RJC has every reason to make Trump look as good as possible, and Trump may be eager to cast himself as a defender of the Jews. It's not clear, however, that accusing Jews of self-hatred is any less offensive than accusing them of dual loyalty. Perhaps Trump and the RJC thinks there is a right way to be Jewish, although at the moment it is not the way most American Jews identify as Jews. The Jewish majority tends to be liberal on social and economic issues and immigration. Nationalism as opposed to patriotism makes them nervous. They support Israel even when they're critical of its government and policies and don't believe Omar or Tlaib speak for them or the party. They want a pro-Israel president in Congress, but consider Israel as one among a number of factors in deciding which politicians and policies they support. As a result, American Jews vote overwhelmingly for Democrats as they did in 2016 and 2018. Big Jewish districts tend to deliver mainstream pro-Israel liberal Democrats like Florida's Debbie Wasserman Schultz and New York's Jerry Nadler. They tend to want to see their pluralistic democratic values reflected in Israel. And polls have shown that they, like most Democratic voters, see support for Israel and criticism of Israel's government policies as totally compatible. Few Jews appreciate others, including fellow Jews, telling them how they should be Jewish. If they're loyal to anything, it's to the idea that all Jews get to decide for themselves what kind of Jew they want to be. Andrew Sillo Carroll is JTA's editor-in-chief, was previously editor-in-chief and CEO of the New Jersey Jewish News, and wrote a column for the Times of Israel. He was also managing director of the Forward newspaper and a reporter for the Jewish Telegraphic Agency before he became the editor. I've got a couple other things on this. Cable talk show host and comedian Bill Maher fired back at Rashida Tlaib after the freshman congresswoman called for boycotting his HBO show, where he criticized the anti-Israel BDS movement that both she and Representative Ilhan Omar have been vocally supporting. The congresswoman said, "I'm tired of folks discrediting a form of speech that's centered on equality and freedom. That's how they tried to discredit and stop the boycott to stand up against the apartheid in South Africa." Maher responded on Twitter, "Some people have one move only, boycott, cancel, make go away. But here's the thing. The House voted 318-17 to condemn the BDS movement, including 93% of Democrats. Does Tlaib want to boycott 93% of her own party? In July, a whopping 99% of Democrats voted for an anti-BDS resolution in the House of Representatives. The back and forth began when Maher said on his latest show that BDS is a bullshit purity test by people who want to appear woke but actually slept through the history class. It's predicated on this notion, I think it's very shallow thinking, that the Jews in Israel are mostly white and the Palestinians are browner, so they must be innocent and correct and the Jews must be wrong. As if the occupation came out of the blue and this completely peaceful people found themselves occupied. Forget about the intifadas and the suicide bombings and the rockets and the wars." Maher added, "Let me read Omar Baghouti, one of the co-founders of the movement. His quote, 'No rational Palestinian would ever accept a Jewish state in Palestine.' So that's what that comes from, this movement, someone who doesn't want a Jewish state at all. Somehow this side never gets presented in the American media. It's very odd." Let's go from there to our usual reading of this week's Parsha. It's Ekev, and here is commentary by Rabbi Shlomo Riskin. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 12 through chapter 11, verse 25. "Not by bread alone does a human being live, but rather by that which comes forth from the Lord's mouth does a human being live." Deuteronomy 8:3. How does the Bible view life, that span of time that every individual desperately wishes to preserve and to lengthen, but which is rarely properly utilized? The sad truth is that no one is quite certain how best to use whatever time he or she may be given or to what purpose to dedicate it. How best to spend one's life is the question of questions. And one who lives without asking and answering that question runs the risk of leaving this world without ever having lived at all. Apparently, the Almighty came to the conclusion that the newly freed Israelites were not yet ready to enter the Promised Land. They required an educational training period of 40 years, a complete generation in the desert no man's land. They were to experience a kind of trial by heat and by cold, with lessons to be learned by a strange mixture of divine bounty mixed with human uncertainty. From Deuteronomy 8:1-3, you shall remember the entire journey on which the Lord your God led you these 40 years in the desert in order to afflict you, to test you to know that which is in your heart. Will you keep his commandments or not? He will afflict you, and he will make you hungry. He will provide you with manna to eat, which neither you nor your ancestors experienced previously, in order to teach you that not by bread alone does a human being live, but rather by that which comes forth from the Lord's mouth does the human being live. This major desert experience of the manna was a kind of time out from the Garden of Eden punishment that by the sweat of your brow shall you eat bread. On the one hand, God was the beneficent provider of food, a food which the Israelites only had to gather rather than to manufacture, with every individual receiving precisely what he needed each day. On the other hand, the Israelites had neither the discomfiture nor the exhilaration which is derived from the competition, the ingenuity, the sickness unto death of failure, and the dizzying satisfaction of success, which accompany the back-breaking, tension-producing dedication to the marketplace or the agricultural farm. What was the significance of the manna? Which lesson did it convey? The most ancient and, I believe, authentic versions of the rabbinically accepted Aramaic translation of the biblical text, Targum Onkelos, translates the last words of the verse we have just cited. Not by bread alone does a human being exist, but rather by that which comes forth from God's mouth does a human being live. Targum differentiates between the bread necessary for human existence and the word of God essential to human life. Existence is a physical subsistence. Life is essence, the word of God, the life of spirit, of intellect, of sensitivity, of a love. For a clear explanation of Targum's intent, let us study the second Mishnah in the seventh tractate of seventh chapter of tractate Shabbat, where the Mishnah provides us with a list of the 39 prohibited physical activities on the Sabbath. The Midrash generally assumes that the source of these prohibited activities is the list of the very constructive acts involved in the building of the tabernacle. Whichever creative acts were involved in the construction of the tabernacle were prohibited on the Sabbath. However, one of the prohibited activities of this Mishnah is baking, and in the construction of the Mishkan, the dye extracts of the plants had to be boiled in order to color the fabrics used to beautify the sanctuary. So why does the Mishnah list baking rather than boiling? The Talmud explains the discrepancy by saying that the Mishnah wished to highlight the procedures in bread manufacture, and indeed, when looking at the prohibited acts from this perspective, the entire Mishnah assumes a wholly different focus. First, it prohibits bread manufacture, then clothing manufacture, then leather manufacture, and finally acts of building. In effect, the Mishnah is teaching that the search for food, clothing, and shelter, so central to physical existence and nutritional substance, is to be eschewed on the Sabbath day. The days of the week are for physical existence. The Sabbath is for spiritual and intellectual life. And existence and life are the two most crucial elements of our human sojourn in this world. The truth is that animals, no less than humans, also require food, clothing, protection from the elements, and shelter. What makes the human being uniquely human is that which goes beyond physical existence, the spiritual spark of God within him or her, the soul, the heart, and the mind of the human being, which enables him or her to think, to give, to communicate with the other, to love, to repair, and to create. Most human beings spend their lives working for their physical existence, amassing commodity, and the ultimate commodity, money, and collecting objects and things. In the desert, they were freed from this pursuit, with the exception of the little time it would take to gather the manna, and no one could take more than his or her needed portion. They could spend the great majority of their time receiving and pondering over God's words, God's desire that we share with those less fortunate, God's gift of family and friendship and community and love. The Sabbath day prohibits physical work, but stresses family togetherness, Torah study, communal prayer, time out for God, meditation and nature walks. The Sabbath is a day of life, not mere existence. The desert experience was a kind of eternal Sabbath, a taste of a more perfect world when we learned to do without material extras, but would hopefully begin to understand that the real purpose of human life would be to live by God's words. And in that more perfect world, we would hopefully learn the necessities for our existence. Just as our existence itself is fundamentally a gift from God, that the ultimate purpose for our existence is to link ourselves to life, to God, to his will, and his eternity. On the Sabbath, we sanctify wine, we bless the challah bread, we use the table of food as a means for songs of praise to God and words of Torah. No wonder, then, that the Hebrew word chayim is always in the plural, because there can be no meaningful human life devoid of loving relationships with others. The two-letter yuds, chus, in the center of the word are shortened form of expressing God's name, and the outer words form the word hum, warm. Love, sensitivity, and caring are central for meaningful human activity on earth. Rabbi Yitzchak of Berdyshev once saw a person running to and fro as if he were chasing his own tail. "Where are you running?" he asked. "I'm running to make a living," came the reply. "Just make sure in the process you don't lose your life," remarked the wise rabbi. Shabbat Shalom from Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, Chancellor Emeritus of Or Torah Stone and Chief Rabbi of Ephrat, Israel. What's on the calendar? Well, I see for this week, the only item we have is Wise Temple's Family Engagement Ice Cream Social, Sunday, August 25th, from 3 to 4:30 p.m. at Isaac M. Wise Temple. Tonight is Shabbat. Light candles at 8:02 p.m. and Shabbat will end at 9:02 on Saturday evening. This has been the American Israelite Program. I'm Malcolm Bernstein, and I'll be back with you again next week. Have a good week. Bye-bye.